want to obviously give you the opportunity to ask some questions as well, but I wanted to kick it off by first of all giving Malika an opportunity to introduce herself. I think no one needs an introduction of Property Guru. I think we all used it if we live in Singapore at some stage to find an apartment or a house. More recently, I've got to say, I get more and more depressed when I go into your platform because the rental prices are just shocking. But Malika, we all know Property Guru from a user perspective, but I know there's a lot more to Property Guru than what we see at the front end. Can you give a quick introduction to Property Guru and also your role as the VP for strategy?
Hello, everyone. Thank you. Thank you, Lee, for the opportunity to be here. I've been at Property Guru about 5 years, and I head up primarily our growth ambitions. So I've been involved in expanding our scope from the core marketplaces platform, well-known and well-loved, into fintech and data as adjacencies, most recently to home services as well, acquiring Sendhelper. So organic and inorganic growth is really what I do. And before that, I was at Lazada for a short stint and BCG, so strategy consulting background. It's great to be here. I think at Property Guru, we've gone through all the disruptions that you've seen and heard of in the last 5 years. But I think we were really one of the lucky few and managed to list on the New York Stock Exchange in 2021 as well. And I think we're in a very, very good position as a business, I would say. I'm happy to talk more about being a resilient business in that sense.
Oh, thank you. Let's share this. I was just actually saying, I mean, you're the poster child success story for Singapore. You know, you've got obviously a massive track. I mean, Property Guru is actually has quite a strong history, but over the last 5 to 10 years, massive growth. You know, leading into the IPO that you did last year at the New York Stock Exchange. Although probably Singapore is not too happy that you didn't choose the SGX for your listing, but I understand why. But when we talk about these topics of resiliency, and you said like it's obviously very relevant to you. For a high scaling or rapidly scaling business, what does resiliency mean for you, and what are the critical success factors that make property resilient?
I was thinking a lot about that just from being invited to this panel about what does business resilience mean to us and how we think about it, right? So I think there are primarily three things that I will say, just reflecting on our time going backwards. The first one is really trust and goodwill. The second one is really knowledge and clarity. And the third one, I would say, is really being open to opportunity or a growth mindset. So the first one really is about trust and goodwill. So, you know, today we talked a lot about the technological basis of resilience. But things are changing so fast around us that I really believe that you can't do anything unless you have trusted people around you, people that trust you. So trust and goodwill, really, that you've built up. And that goes to basically partners, customers, employees, investors. If you've got the trust and the backing of your customers, they believe in you. If your employees know you have their back, they believe in you. If your investors know that you're on the right track and they believe in you, I think that is gold in a changing scenario, right, situation. And I think Property Guru has, and how do you get there? So it's very easy to say, oh, you should have the trust. How do you get there? I think it's by building a really solid business, which is just going all the way back to fundamentals. Deliver value to your customers. Take care of your employees. A lot of new age companies don't seem to really have the focus on that so much. We see a lot of that. And also in terms of really being a profitable company, right? Have a focus on your profit. Have a focus on the cash flow. This seems to be sort of the today's flavor in the investment market. But actually, I remember coming into Property Guru, 5 years ago, and being part of a strategic discussion where we had so much focus on how we were going to be able to deliver a profitable bottom line, right? Which we're one of the very few new age tech companies who were already operationally profitable and cash flow positive in 2019. Things then changed a little bit since then, but the focus on that, right? And I think this is sustainability, and this is not different. You're building a business. It's just a business, right? You've got to deliver money. You've got to deliver bottom line profits and cash profits. I think it's really just the basics, right? And having a stable management team to do that is very, very important. A grown-up management team. Focusing on your costs, focusing on the purse strings in good times and bad will open up the optionality when the times go bad, right? If you don't do that, if you overspend in the good times, then you run out of options very quickly. You run out of runway. So just build a good business, you know, have a focus on the fundamentals. And that brings me to the second point I was making, which is knowledge and clarity is very important. I'm in the business of strategy, of course, you know, I'll plug, for that. But you need to kind of know what business you're in. It goes to the point, Kaushik, you were making about Zara. You need to know what's your business model and what business you're in. So we're also happily in a business with a business model where even if demand goes down or supply goes down, actually, since we connect the two through a platform, we're actually somewhat insulated from declines in demand and declines in supply. So that is just an inherent sort of business model resilience that platforms have, for example, right? So you've got to know what are your weak points. In Zara's case, the business model they had built was so susceptible to supply chain disruption. Knowing that that's your core business model, 6 to 9 months to new fashion, you've got to be prepared for that. If you don't know what your business is and you're not clear about that, then that's a big problem. So I would strongly suggest that everybody have things like a business model canvas or a strategy on a page to really just boil down your business to the basic fundamentals, to the simplest sources, and to think through really how does this business work? How does this business model work? Where are you most susceptible? It'll become very clear. And that kind of knowledge and clarity, I think also, you know, ecosystem has actually helped us as well in terms of, you know, when we were thinking through our developer strategy, you know, you need to build knowledge sources. So both internally and externally, make sure that you have the teams and the partnerships that can support you build that knowledge and that clarity. And the third thing is then, when you have knowledge and clarity, when you have trust and goodwill, you can actually flip the risk on its head. The risk can become an opportunity. So I think most of you know that good investors make most of their money in bad times. I don't think it's different for businesses. Good businesses build tremendous value in bad times. So we've gone and acquired plenty of companies. We've fundraised, we've IPO listed, we've got access to incredible talent. And the only way you can do that is to really flip that switch and know what you want to do so that when the opportunity comes, you're ready. And so to have this sort of a growth mindset building on the preparation of the other two aspects, I think you can get really the most out of a bad situation.
Thank you, Malika. Just if you have a question, can you please already maybe raise your hand? We've got a roaming mic going around as well, so I want to open it up shortly. I just want to do a quick follow-up question. And I direct it to you, Malika, but Pete or Kaushik, if you want to jump in, please feel free. Traditionally, strategies are designed around a time span of about 3 to 5 years. But now we've seen that with the volatility, every 12 to 18 months, a significant event is impacting our business. So is the time frame of planning of 3 to 5 years still valid? And secondly, if it is, how do you keep true to your strategy without being distracted by the short-term disruptive events that you are responding to on an operational level?
Yeah, I think it's a very relevant question, right? Obviously, it's really difficult for people to deal with permanently changing things, right? People hate change, basically. So I would say that you must have a map, right? You must have some kind of a map. A strategy is just a map, right? To kind of know where you're going. So I'll share with you how we do it at Property Guru, and I think that kind of provides a decent framework for thinking through things. The first framework that we use is something called Core Strategy and Venture, CSV. So core, we define it as, you know the business questions to ask, but you also know the answer. This is how your business is currently making money. You know what to do, right? You know how you, what is the value you deliver. That's core. That's not going to go away, right? You have to keep executing on that. The second question is really more strategy, right? Strategy is about, I know the question, but I don't know the answer. Venture is, I don't know the question. So I have no idea how to get to the answer. Let me put it in a very accessible way, right? Let's say you want to go somewhere. You want to come to the Fullerton building, right? So core is, I know how to get to the Fullerton. Like, I know that I need to get to the Fullerton, and I kind of know how to get to the Fullerton. I have a map to guide me. This is your core of your business, right? Now this, what should you do? You should use everything that you have at your disposal to get here as quickly and at the lowest cost and in the most effective way as possible, right? This is where all your technology comes into play, all your enablers, your people, your processes, technology comes into play. Nothing should stop you from this. This is your core of your business. You've got to execute this as flawlessly, as fast, as cheaply as possible, right? And deliver the highest value. The second one is strategy. Strategy means, you know, you need to get to the Fullerton, but you have no idea how. You don't know where it is, right? You kind of know, you might know kind of it's in the CBD, but I don't really know. Now, what are you going to do? If you have a car, use the car. This is your strategic asset, right? I'll get out in a car. I know that it might take me longer. I know that I probably need to spend more than I would to get there. And, you know, these are some milestones. I know kind of it's roughly near a bridge. There should be a river somewhere in the area. So you set your markers. You set up your milestones. You work backwards. But you actually are willing to invest, willing to be patient. You know it's going to take longer. You know it's going to cost more. You're prepared for the journey. But you also know when to pull the plug. Very important for strategic ventures, right? You can buy the expertise, you can talk to people, you can research things, but ultimately, you need to be willing to be patient and invest. Venture is completely, you have no idea. You have no idea that it's the full, you don't know, you're not getting to the Fullerton. You just know that you need something, but you don't know how to get there, right? This requires a tremendous amount of risk-taking, and a completely different mindset. I mean, the people who thrive in venture settings are typically different. One way you can do venture is through acquisition, right? One way you can do it is to find small companies where you have people who are serving needs that you know will come up in the future, who are anticipating the future much faster than large companies can. So this is obviously one way to grow, right? Another way is to think through experimentation models and hackathons. Third way, you can be really clear again about what are the boundaries of where you are going. And one way that we use apart from CSV at Property Guru to be really clear about the boundaries where we're going is to be really clear about where we are not going. So one way that you can really become very clear about venture situations is to define what we call no-fly zones. Okay, we know we're not going after that. We know we're not going after this particular use case, this particular customer, this particular need, because that's not where we think things will end up. So think about these two frameworks, and I hope they help you. And I think execution is really about those three things we talked about, right? People, process, and technology. There are many things you can do in your strategic planning process to help your people be more comfortable and confident, bring their best selves to work, take more risk, have more open conversations. And then technology, I think a lot of you in the room probably have this nailed or figured out, but all these pivots that you want to do on the business side require technological capabilities and scalable architectures and scalable technologies, and that's a hugely important enabler as well.
Thank you. Nevin,
I have a question for Pete, and thanks for a very insightful presentation. What is the latest on cloud? What's the verdict there? You know, is it the bad boy who needs to be kept out of the house, or is it par for the course, or is there anything, any new realization? And the second follow-through question from there is on data sovereignty. So as businesses are looking to strategically recalibrate their cortex, is it likely that everything has to be within the country, and hence there are, you know, borders that you have to now work within, or is it more interoperable? You see it to be more interoperable. Two things, cloud and data sovereignty.
Sure. Come on. look, cloud isn't bad. Cloud is good, right? And I hope you know I didn't infer a message that cloud wasn't positive. I think it is, and it's necessary. I think the key message around cloud computing is really giving it the context for what it is. Cloud for cloud's sake is not good. And we've been talking for a little while now that cloud computing is actually a transition state to get us to where we need to be to do all these other things. And so, and mobility is the same. Like enterprise mobility, you know, only really sort of started to come into things in the late 2000s, and cloud was even after that. So, cloud is an absolutely necessary utility service that we need, but it can't be in and of itself a service or a destination. And I think, you know, that's part of the reason that we're starting to see a lot of organizations that did go full cloud now start to rehabituate some of their cloud services, because cloud isn't for every single service, and it's not supposed to be like that. And it's not always cheaper, and it's not always better, and it's not always faster, depending on the sorts of services that you want to do. So it's sort of taken us 10 years, and the drive was, yeah, get to cloud, because we've seen massive growth. We will continue to see massive growth in cloud because of that first megatrend, which is that data black hole. It's all these things coming together. You need cloud computing to do that, and cloud being the basis of so many of the modern application platforms and things as well. So that's the first thing. In terms of data sovereignty, I think we're seeing, you know, changes, and again, it's those global incidents which drives the changes, certainly in terms of the legislation and regulations, either at a country level or an industry level. Most of the, you know, some of the strictest sovereignty laws we're still seeing in Asian countries, and so we're still seeing a bit of a land grab in certain countries to build hyperscaler data centers in countries around the region. So I think, you know, they will continue to persist until you know it's really clear that they're throwing up barriers to some of the things that we've been talking about today. The other the other interesting thing is I don't think we've seen the last in terms, or I don't think the cloud market has settled in this region. There's a cloud provider in India which is looking to build somewhere between 50 and 70 data centers in the next 5 or 6 years. Now, that doesn't scream to you country-specific hyperscaler, I don't know what does. So it's, some of the challenges that we need to address in terms of data sovereignty are actually going to come down to the efficiencies and the actual capital market investments in the data centers that we've seen in the last 10 years, where there's been a lot of institutional investments into these data centers, but it's not that they're inefficient, but they're inefficient compared to the modern capabilities. They're starting to put pressure on our desire to solve some of these existential reality problems like sustainability, you know, which in Singapore is land and it's power and it's water and it's all these sorts of things, but there are solutions to that. So data centers and cloud from a physical place is a fascinating, space. So.
Thanks, Pete. Anna.
Thanks, all of you. Fantastic conversation. Pete, another question for you around what I believe to be also an existential risk, but it kind of cuts across everything that you've spoken about, which is the incidence of cryptocurrency. So we all speak about that in a very kind of high-level sense, but having run, I've now run a cloud services business and also been the CEO of a bank. So I can see where the capital flows and the investment, particularly in this region, for the use of cryptocurrency is a material existential event. So, and that's a geopolitical discussion, but I would like to hear your point of view on where is and where do you think the use of cryptocurrency, you know, across the all of those different six agenda items, if you will, is going to impact business going forward.
Yeah, sure. And look, that's a great question. And I will say up front, I don't consider myself a crypto expert, but I've got plenty of opinions on how this
No one is.
In.
I think nobody yeah. is. But so, we all talk about it as if we are. Yeah. But I want to know how it's going to actually impact economies.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think we only have to look at what's been going on in the US to realize that crypto is in and of itself one of these global events. I didn't put it up on the list, but if you start to look at how close the US was to regulation before Sam Bankman-Fried sort of took his $40 billion and spent it on apartments and ill-gotten gains and all that kind of stuff, I think that's a perfect example where these inflection points are required to drive the necessary change into financial markets. And so I think, you know, out of today's session, I would certainly, encourage you to look at that resilient adaptation architecture, specifically from the perspective of cryptocurrency, like we sort of did at the back end for cybersecurity. And it would be a fascinating view for what that looks like, either on a just from a topic or from a regional perspective as well. I think it's also the challenge with crypto is that it's not just tied to financial markets; it is tied to the cloud services market as well. And so some of the
So much of that increase in the appetite to build data centers is being driven by very large Chinese interests wanting to be able to facilitate the flow of capital in and out of the region.
And I agree. And it's also tied to energy markets. Like this is the crazy thing when you start to think about crypto. So it's tied to the financial markets, either trying to get it in or keep it out because they're not playing. It's tied to the regulatory markets because governments are trying to figure out what the hell it is and where it fits. It's tied to the technology markets through cloud because you need the data centers and supercomputers to run it. And it's tied to the energy markets because some of the changes we're seeing in the existential reality is that the big institutional investors are using their data centers for grid firming of the energy networks, but also when the grid doesn't need excess energy to pour it into the data centers to mine crypto to pay for the data center and the services. And so I can give you a couple of examples of where that's happening. So it's the perfect example where that has tentacles into so many different industries and it does require this new sort of 21st century strategy. You can't have a data center strategy. You can't have a banking strategy. You can't have an energy strategy. You've got to have, what is the core of this? And cloud, you can't have a cloud strategy. You need a cryptocurrency resilient adaptation strategy to deal with this, which is the exact point. And thank you for raising it and asking the question, because it is the perfect example of a 21st century platform that we haven't had to deal with before.
Thank you, Anna. We've got maybe time for one quick question. I know that actually Malika is due to have a strategy session with her team at 10:30, so she pushed it out a little bit. Any one last question? Sesh, you have a question.
Thank you. You know, you can't keep me away from talking, right? So, Malika, my question to you, as someone I admire, as a woman leader, you spoke about people strategy. This is completely different from the topic that we've been talking about, right? How do you build that resilience in workforce, and how do you build a gender equal workforce? Completely different, and I'm going to throw you that curveball.
Thanks. That was a quick question.
Yes. Okay. In 30
loaded,
seconds.
Very loaded. So I'll give you 2 minutes to answer that.
I'll try to keep it short. I think it's the top and the middle. In our case now, if you look at our extended leadership team, we've worked over years where more than half of it is female, right? Starting at the top is very important. Having the right intentions, having the right discussions. And this applies to both broader culture and gender diversity, diversity of all sorts. Building the culture from the top and the vision and your values also have to support people being themselves, I think. This is something that Property Guru does very well, which is there's no one model. You are welcome to be yourself and thrive as yourself. So there's a lot of freedom, autonomy, flexibility. I think as a new age tech company, this is sort of par for the course, but I do think it also helps you show up and turn up as yourself, which is just the best thing you can do, right? And that's very encouraged and nurtured. The middle is very important because the middle affects everything, right? So having a strong culture of engagement with your middle management, having a very strong training program for your middle and management, for new leaders, for new managers, having some processes to enable them, having the automation bases so that they're not doing grunt work, they have time to focus on their people, and growing their people is very important. So, yeah, focus on the top and the middle to get the culture right.